Okay, so I'm an applied mathematician, and I try to learn things from infectious disease data about infectious diseases and make mathematical models that help us understand dynamics and develop control strategies for infectious diseases. And I'm going to focus today talking about a very exciting data set that I have begun to work on over the last year or so, which is the bills of mortality of London, England, which go back to 1592. And there are weekly records of mortality from all sorts of causes back to 1592. And so that's what I'm talking about when I say lessons from death. It's lessons that we can learn by analyzing these bills of mortality. And before I dive into that, I want to just motivate the sort of field of study that this falls into. Why would we, and that's the ecology and evolution of infectious diseases, and so why would we want to study ecology and evolution of infectious disease? And probably for most people here, there's one obvious answer, which is that it's very significant from a public health point of view. So if we can understand patterns of disease dynamics in the past and how diseases evolve, that can help us develop better control strategies for diseases that we're trying to control right now. Some records of epidemics, analyzing those, making models that predict what happens there might help us gain insights that will lead us to better strategies for containing new pathogens when they enter the population. Another reason for doing this is really a sort of more basic scientific reason, which is the ecological significance of this kind of work. And that's that, you know, from an ecologist's point of view, what we're doing is studying host-parasite interactions, with the host being humans in the case that we're going to talk about, and the parasites being viruses or bacteria or other organisms. And understanding host-parasite ecology is something of fundamental importance in for ecologists. But most ecologists that study, and whether it's host and parasite or predator and prey, the data that they usually have available are pretty poor when compared to the type of data that I'm going to be talking about, you know, weekly records over centuries. I mean, it's really extraordinary. And so we can benefit in terms of our overall understanding of ecology by gaining a better understanding from these infectious disease and mortality records. And another thing, too, is that the typical sorts of systems that ecologists study, like predator and prey, lynx and hare or whatever, even if they have what are excellent data, they're much less likely to be able to build a mathematical model that can explain the dynamics, because if you have a lynx that prefers to hunt for hares, but it doesn't find hares, it will eat another organism, right? Whereas if measles is circulating in the population and everybody is immune, it doesn't just suddenly decide to jump into another species. I mean, so we have a much more contained system. We're much more likely to build simple models that can explain the dynamics. So we really have a great deal of potential to understand ecology in a deeper way from these sorts of data and modeling. So, and sort of some of the things that I'll talk about that we can learn by analyzing and using mathematical models to understand these data are, for example, quantifying transmissibility of pathogens. And that's really critical because, besides its intrinsic interest, because it'll if we can quantify the transmissibility, it allows us to predict things that epidemiologists really want to know when about pathogens. What's the final size of an epidemic likely to be? And what sorts of control strategies are likely to be most effective? Well, that depends very strongly on the transmissibility. And another thing is trying to just understand the dynamics, the spread, both spatially and temporally. of infectious diseases, so that we can understand things like why diseases are seasonal, if they are, what the frequency of epidemics is, whether the frequency changes, what the spatial structure of epidemic patterns is, why it is the way it is, and how and why disease pathogens evolve. Well, these bills of mortality contain hundreds of diseases that we could study, and I'm going to focus on one which gave rise to a very famous epidemic, the Great Plague of London. And the work that I've been doing on the Great Plague is together with my former postdoc, Junling Ma, who is now an assistant professor in mathematics at the University of Victoria. So, the Great Plague. What do we want to know about it? Well, I mean, unless you've read a lot, you probably might have an impression that these plagues were caused by bubonic plague, Yersinia pestis, but there's actually quite a bit of debate about whether that was really the organism that caused the Great Plague and other plagues going further back in time. And I'll argue that we might be able to help towards determining that with the types of analysis that I'll talk about. And, you know, there are other questions like, you know, people at the time, if you read the historical records, thought this was incredibly transmissible, but, I mean, what do we make of that? If we can quantify the transmissibility, is that consistent with what the historical descriptions tend to say? And you might wonder whether this is going to be relevant in 2007, beyond the issues of understanding ecology of disease. And if it really is bubonic plague, then it's definitely relevant to understand how the disease spread in this community, because it's considered to be a major threat for bioterrorism. The more we can learn about it from past epidemics, the better off we might be, should it be intentionally introduced in the future. Okay, so I'm going to do a few things. I'm going to talk about where this happened. I will talk about the data sources in a little bit more detail. I'll describe the temporal and spatial patterns of the Great Plague, and then I'll talk about how we've estimated transmissibility of the pathogen. Okay, and feel free to interrupt me anytime. Okay, so where did this happen? Well, it happened on this island that is no doubt familiar, and more specifically in the southeast corner of that island. And if we blow up this obviously satellite view, we see a current view of the Greater London area. You can see the Thames River. If we blow up a little bit further, we can start to get a sense of where our field work was done for this project. So it was at the Guildhall manuscript section in the Guildhall Library in central London. And just to give you a flavor for where this is, orient you, if you happen to know London, there's Regent's Park, Hyde Park, London Bridge, which is an important point, St. Paul's Cathedral, Buckingham Palace. And even this is actually much larger than the area of interest in 1665. So in 1665, it was this very small area of modern central London, which didn't even include Buckingham's Palace, and it's only about 2 miles across. So, what did London look like then? It looked something like this, and I'll just point out a couple of, this is a sketch from the time. Here's St. Paul's Cathedral, which doesn't look anything like that now because it burnt down in 1666 in the Great Fire of London. And the other really striking feature here is London Bridge, and London Bridge doesn't look like that now. If you've seen older photos, you might have seen something like this in the 19th century, where it was you usually saw people walking across a nice-looking bridge. Now, it's hardly an attractive structure. But in 1665, it was a very beautiful covered bridge on which people lived. And that last fact may be something that's relevant to some of the things that we'll talk about a little later. Okay, so that's where it occurred. What about the data that I've been talking about? Well, I said it comes from these bills of mortality. I've had research assistants in London photographing these bills for months. And here's an example. And the bills at this time came in this form, so there are typically two pages. On the left, a list of causes of death and the numbers of individuals who died from the various causes. And on the right, I'll come back to the right. So on the left, you can see various causes, and some of these are quite amusing. We could spend, so at the top, I don't know if you can read it, it says frighted, so one person died of being frighted to death, three people died of grief, not usually the sorts of causes that you see currently in mortality records, but then there are other more familiar things, consumption, which is tuberculosis probably, and various other things, but most striking is this line here, plague. 5,533 people died of plague that week, and that wasn't the worst week. And they also list the number of christenings, so lower bound on the number of births, 146. Well, the death rate that week was overwhelming, the birth rate. This was a bad time in London. On the right-hand side here, there is a list of each of the 130 parishes of London and the number of deaths from plague and in total in each of these parishes. So it gives us this remarkable spatial record of the plague. That tiny area divided into 130 regions. Now, this bill that I've shown you is a nice printed bill. Most of the data that we have are actually, so they made these bills and they're handwritten records, and this is an example. But fortunately, they were very careful and the handwriting is exceptionally clear, so it's very rare that we have any doubt about what they were writing. It does mean, however, that all the data must be entered by hand. There's no way of using optical character recognition or any other such clever modern tool, so it's quite labor-intensive to digitize these data. Okay, well, if we do that, we digitize the data week by week, what do they look like? Well, I mentioned these data go back to 1592, so I'll show you the pattern of plague epidemics in London from 1592 to 1665, with the last big peak being the one we're going to focus on, the Great Plague. But there were three other very substantial plagues in London, and then there were periods of recurrent plague epidemics of much lower magnitude. So there's a very interesting problem there about why this was the pattern of plague epidemics. And that's a very interesting problem that I won't focus on today. But I'll just mention as a matter of interest that, you know, we're going to focus on the Great Plague, for which we have the best data. But each of these plagues actually killed the same proportion of the population of London, which was about 20% of those living in London. It's just that this was a century during which London exploded in population size. Okay, so let's then focus on the Great Plague. And if we just look at that, this is what we see. It really took off in the late spring and went on until and was basically over in the fall. And I plotted births as well in blue, so just again to emphasize the magnitude of this. If you go through an experience where 20% of the people that you know are dead a year later, it would have a very serious effect on your life. So, what kind of questions should we be asking and that we might be able to answer? So I've just cut out the central part of that. So one question is, can we reliably estimate transmissibility from this sort of epidemic curve? Okay, well, I'll talk a bit about how we might do that, but in order for us to do that, just from this data, by the way, this particular plot of the aggregate plague epidemic has been plotted many times before. What people haven't done is actually dug out all the records for each of the individual parishes, and that'll be, you'll see that there's some, why that's pretty useful to do. But anyway, if we were going to estimate transmissibility from this graph, we'd be implicitly assuming that the population is homogeneously mixed. Now, that may be a very reasonable thing to do when the, you know, the diameter of the city is only 2 miles. Maybe on that scale, that's fair. You know, 4 square miles, maybe approximately pi square miles. On such a small area, it may be very reasonable to think that the population is mixed, but we should be able to test that with the kind of data that we have. And so a related question then is, did the disease become evident in all parts of the city simultaneously, or is there some evidence for spatial spread? And given that we've got these parish-level data, we should be able to answer that effectively. So just to get a first cut at that, I will show you these epidemic curves for the first few parishes that were infected with plague or that recorded deaths from plague. So here they are. Well, they're not simultaneous. And in fact, the delay in the peak between the first parish and the second parish to be infected is a couple of months, I think. So something serious is happening spatially, it seems. But here is rescaled down the aggregate curve. So, you know, it could just be that the first, they were spread from somewhere, and then after it really got going, it all mixed up. So we haven't really answered that question. But we have learned that there's some spatial record in these data. So let's actually have a proper look at the spatial pattern to see how plausible homogeneous mixing is, or whether there's anything interesting about the spatial pattern. Okay, so that's what I will move to now. So how did we go about doing this? Well, we encoded the boundaries of all the parishes with standard geographical information system format. And I'm going to show you a visualization of the epidemic that in which we overlay the parish boundaries onto what's actually a modern map from 1911, just because, well, I'll show you the map so you can see why I did this, but I just wanted to get my way around London now, and I don't have a map at the moment at the time that allows me to see that sort of this faint thing, but I'll get there. But for the moment, this is not, so there isn't really in 1665 evidence of population way out in the corners, but the main thing here is that you can see the parishes of London have their boundaries marked in red. The wall of London, it was a walled city, is in yellow. London Bridge is here. And so those are the major things to be aware of. And what I'm going to do is color the parishes as they become infected. Okay? So the first parish to be infected was over here on the outside the city, and then I'll just now jump through one step at a time as parishes become infected. If they became infected the same week, then they're the same color. And ask yourself, is there any evidence for spatial spread, or did it quickly become random, or what can we learn from this animation, basically? Okay, well, if that's not evidence for spatial spread, I don't know what is. It's very, very striking and was unexpected to me. And I'll just emphasize a few more things going back. So what happened is, I mean, it started out here, and then it started to spread towards the city. And interestingly, so here, in this week, you can see that it's in two interesting places. It's in a parish that's right next to the bridge, and it's entered a parish that is by a major gate to the city. And in the next week, it crosses into the across the bridge and into the city. And then it just continues over a period of 4 months to encroach amazingly slowly onto the very center of the city. By the way, there are some. So this is the Tower of London. So people were dying there intentionally, but were not buried there. So that's why that's blank. And some of these regions were basically rural. So it's not that nothing happened. Okay, well, I think we've learned, first of all, it doesn't look like a homogeneously mixed city, so we may need to be a bit more careful when trying to estimate what happened, and we've got an interesting problem to try and understand in terms of predicting this kind of spatial spread from a model. But that visualization doesn't really show you everything you'd like to see, it's great for identifying the fact that there was spatial spread, but it doesn't give any indication of the magnitude of the epidemic in each of these places. And so I'm going to show you a much more sophisticated type of visualization that took us a lot more work to produce. And what we did was build a sort of general purpose visualization tool to look at what happens with epidemics like this for which we have spatial data. And it will allow us to get a better flavor for what's going on. So I'm going to get out of, these are just snapshots from this software, and I will get out of PowerPoint. So here we are again. So now the boundaries of the parishes are in white. The date is up on the top right there, and sorry, I've lost my mouse. There it is. Okay. It's very awkward being this way and it being in front of you. It's not doubled on my screen, so forgive me if I seem lack of coordinating. Let me just change the view here a little. And so what we're going to see now is the heights of the cylinders that you'll see. So a lot of the spread has already happened, but it's very small numbers of cases. And then once you get into the summer, you start seeing a really, really different sort of behavior. Okay, so now it's just about over. We're into the winter. But interestingly, it continues to smolder for a very long time. And I'll just change the view because I find it useful to look at it sideways like this, because you can just see the smoldering. And it goes on. I mean, we're way after the end of the epidemic. It continues to smolder until the end of 1666, when the last plague death was recorded. Okay, so there's a lot of things we can learn from this sort of thing. And you know, you can imagine you spend a lot of time, blow it up, change angles, slow it down, look at what's happening over regions. I find this a very helpful tool for figuring out what was happening and forming.
Question.
Yeah.
If somebody got the plague, they could recover from it, right?
Sure. 100%. Well, we don't know exactly what the mortality rate was, but there were definitely people who survived.
And once you survived, were you then immune?
Well, seeing as we don't really know what the pathogen was, it's a little hard for us to say, but it seems likely. I don't know. Do you know with Yersinia pestis, what's the immunity? Yeah.
I guess if the survival rate is low enough, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think the kids would help. I think it's above 80%.
Okay.
Well, that, yeah, I'll come to that actually. Yeah, there's different forms of Actually, maybe I mentioned that a bit. I didn't. It was probably on a slide earlier. There's a so bubonic plague is spread by infected fleas that bite rats or other rodents and then bite humans. But the same organism, a pathogen, can, if it gets into the respiratory tract and lungs, can lead to what's called pneumonic plague, which is then human-to-human transmissible. And what pneumonic plague has almost 100% mortality. And one question is whether this could have been caused, are we just looking at tracking of a rat disease with people being, and not, or is, must it have been pneumonic plague? And that's one of the things we might hope to address.
Can I also ask while you're
Yeah.
What exactly do you mean by rat? Do you mean the extent physical extent of the area that's being covered? I'm thinking more of a fire spread, but it didn't.
You're
spreading
up a figure. Well, of course, there's a couple of factors there. The fact that it didn't look continuous, it might not really be continuous, or it might just be that, you know, this is weekly data, and it's mortality, and it appears to make jumps sometimes that weren't really jumps because, you know, somebody got infected but died later than somebody else who got infected later, and you can end up, and so it's, I think with this picture it's actually consistent with the idea that there was continuous spatial spread. We certainly couldn't rule that out. But it's also possible people walk across a city and infect somebody and that it really wasn't spatial. Yeah.
Perhaps.
On the face of it, yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
okay.
I don't know, but if there's better terminology, I'm not sure what it is, but yeah.
You could do something with the software that would help, I think, people understand that question. Namely, take the numbers you've got. And model instead something that really is spread and rapid, where the probability of a site becoming a focus the next week is determined completely randomly, independent of its spatial position, and just do the same graph week by week when you have really random incidents.
Right, and yeah, and unfortunately, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious the software can be used for simulations as well, to visualize simulations as well. We haven't got there yet, so I'm not going to be able to show you anything like that today.
No,
but yeah, yeah,
time,
yeah,
fascinating,
yeah.
To try to compare, because I agree with the question that there is. It doesn't look like a wave going across the city.
Right, but we have to. So we need to ask the question of, if we make a model that's based on rat transmission, could we get something that's consistent with this picture? And that's an exercise we're going to do, but haven't done yet.
But I think it would also be very interesting to see what it would look like if you simply assumed this trend.
Sure.
It'll
look very different because I think it's really obvious from what I showed that it's highly non-random. But well, of course, I've been looking at it longer, but yeah. We can spend time looking at it and playing with the software after if people want, but I should probably move on and give David some time to say something too. Okay, so so this software was written by Junling Ma, who did this whole project with me, but also by a visualization programmer, Kevin Liang. Okay, so what sorts of things, I mean, I guess I've got ahead of myself a bit. So we want to understand what the structure and speed of this wave that you could see encroaching on the city is, you know, and ask whether what you see is consistent with bubonic plague, in particular with rat transmission. What constraints on disease properties could we obtain by comparing simulations to these data? And more generally, can we actually reproduce the spatial dynamics by simulating a model that we understand? I'm sure we can do that. And so more than that, just how much would we be able to constrain the properties of the disease by doing that? Or properties of the mixing patterns of the individuals in the city, which is also an interesting question aside from the disease itself. Okay. So what I will tell you about now is a bit about the work that we've been doing on trying to estimate the transmissibility of this pathogen, whether it was Yersinia pestis or something else. Okay. So the quantity that characterizes transmissibility is what's called the basic reproductive ratio, R0, which is the average number of secondary cases caused by a given primary case in a completely susceptible population. And the kind of really obvious way to estimate this is from real data is if you know the case pedigrees, that is, you know who infected who, whom the whole way through the epidemic, you just count the numbers of infections. But alas, we don't have that kind of data, and in fact, even today, we almost never have data like that. So we need other methods for estimating transmissibility, and I'll mention two that we can do from these type of data that we have, one being via the final size, via an estimate of the final size, and one via the growth rate of the epidemic. And before I do that, you might just enjoy guessing what this number is going to be for the Great Plague of London. So, and for those of you who aren't familiar with these numbers, so for example, highly transmissible diseases, the most extreme is probably malaria, has R0 of about 20, maybe even as high as 100. I mean, it depends on which source you look at. Measles, about 17. Whooping cough, about which we'll hear more about from David, around the same as measles. Smallpox, influenza, SARS, those are all things that are much less transmissible. So where does the Great Plague of London fit in, do you think? Any guesses? Three? Any other? Nobody aiming for a high number? Amongst the highest? Okay, well, let's see. So one way that we can estimate this is from the final size formula. So I'm not going to get into how you derive this, but it's a formula that's been known. I should really cover this up. We're not going to. But so not only for a very broad class of epidemiological models, you can show that there's a relationship between the proportion of the population that will be infected by the end of the epidemic, Z, and this number R0 that we're interested in. And so very crudely, we know just from the mortality records that at least 20% of the population died during this epidemic, which then gives us a lower bound on R0, which is not a very strong lower bound, it would seem, 1.12. Note, by the way, that for the disease to spread at all, it has to be bigger than 1, because if the average number of secondary cases were less than 1, then it couldn't continue to spread. But that does give us a lower bound. At least I'm building in an assumption that we're talking about human-to-human transmissibility, and we can come back to that. Okay, so that's one. But it'd be nice to do better than that crude lower bound. Okay. Well, another thing that we can measure from the data that we have that makes a bit more use of what we have is the growth rate of the epidemic. So, I mean, we have an epidemic that's growing. We can estimate a rate of exponential growth. It's relatively straightforward to do that. We take the log of the data and fit a straight line to it, straightforward, right? And because we have the parish level data, we can do it separately for each of the parishes. And then we can use that, and so we'll get a distribution basically of fitted growth rates from all these parishes. And if we do that, we get this for our estimate of the growth rate. Now I should mention that this is maybe a weird way of getting some kind of confidence interval on this. I don't know of any really sensible way to get a confidence interval on estimate of an exponential growth rate in one place, right? So if we only had the aggregate data, or we try to attach a confidence interval to each of the parishes, it's really not obvious what to do. So if you have brilliant ideas about that, I'd be glad if you'd share them with me. And we've explored various things, but I don't want to get sidetracked on that. I don't think there's a good solution, but at least this is one way of getting some kind of handle on growth rate from the different parishes. Okay, well, if we do that, then we can then, once we've got the growth rate, then to go further, we have to have some kind of model that relates the growth rate to the number we want or not. Okay, so the standard model that many of you are familiar with is, it's called the SEIR model, which divides the population into individuals who are susceptible, exposed, that is infected but not yet infectious, or removed, which, so either recovered and immune or dead. And it turns out that we can express R naught, and you can write this down as a system of differential equations, or cast it in other ways. We can relate R naught, the number we're interested in, to the growth rate and the mean latent period and the mean infectious period. Okay, well, we've just measured the growth rate, but if we don't know what the pathogen is, we're in a bit of trouble because we don't really know what the mean latent and infectious periods are. Okay, but we may be able to get around that. So, but at least we've got a relationship, a model has helped us get a relationship between the growth rate and the number that characterizes transmissibility. Okay, now much more generally than this, it turns out that, never mind that specific model, there's a general relationship between the growth rate and R naught, which depends not on the structure of the model, but only on the distribution of the serial interval. That is, the serial interval is the time between one person being infected and them infecting the next person. There's a distribution of that, those times, and you can show. It's funny, Junling and I derived this formula where we were so proud of ourselves, and I had a meeting with Mark Lipsitch and was telling him about it, and he said, yeah, it's great. We've got a paper in press with that formula. So there you go. So we never submitted that. But it is a very valuable thing because it means that you can, without getting involved in a particular model, you know that you can just explore the sensitivity to your prediction to the distribution of the serial interval, which is something you might think you at least know intuitively. Okay, so now just to get as an example, what I've done is, so I said we've got some kind of handle on the growth rate. So the top two graphs here are for the growth rate being 15, and the bottom two are for the growth rate being 25. It's probably between these two, based on our estimates. The left panels are for a serial where the serial interval is based on an exponentially distributed latent and infectious period, which is very extreme, right? So exponential distributions are much more spread out than what the true distribution would be. And on the right-hand side, it's with both these intervals being fixed, so a delta function. Okay, that's also... So it has to lie between these regions. Okay, so what do we find? Well, basically, if the serial interval is less than a couple of weeks, which from everything I've read, it's hard to argue for it being more than that, then we get a very strong constraint on what R naught can be from this. So it's going to be less than two. Okay, so it's not a very transmissible disease, whatever it is. And if it really is what we know if it's really Yersinia pestis, and this was an epidemic of pneumonic plague, which I think is highly plausible, then of course we do know from modern data what the distributions are, and we get R naught about 1.3. So we get a very weakly transmissible disease. Okay, well, I think that's very interesting. It means that although we think of this as one of the most devastating epidemics of all time, it seems to have been caused by a pathogen that was only very weakly transmissible, with transmissibility no more than SARS or the 1918 flu, which have been found to be very weakly transmissible. But there's there's other aspects to this. So, you know, okay, it's weakly transmissible, but it still was really awful. So, you know, don't be fooled by low transmissibility pathogens, because it looks like, you know, SARS, 1918 flu, the Great Plague of London, those are pretty bad things. We've got to watch out for those weakly transmissible pathogens. Fortunately, though, they're at least in principle the ones that are easiest to control, so gives us some hope. Okay, so we measured, just going a little further with this, we did measure, estimate a growth rate for each of the parishes, and if we look at how the growth rate varies with various things, we might learn something. So the estimated growth rate. So, well, does the epidemic size in the parish tell you anything? No, there appears to be no correlation there. Okay. We know that there was spatial spread. So there's a change in the timing in each of the parishes. So what happens if we plot the growth rate against the time at which the epidemic started in each of these parishes? There we do get a significant but pretty weak correlation. I'm not sure what to make of that. A fifth of the variance is explained by this relationship. You can start to invent your own reasons for that. But if you do a multiple regression, I think you start to get at something that it may be more telling, and that's that. Another thing that we have is we have mortality data going back to 1661 every week, and in the few years before 1665, the population of London was pretty similar. So if we also regress this against the average death in each of the parishes, which is a marker of the population size of the parish, then we get a very strong correlation. And that suggests to me that probably what's going on, this makes some sense, is that the transmissibility increases with population density. Now, to show that properly, we really need to know the density in each of these parishes, and we're not there yet. I mean, we can estimate the we know the areas of the parishes, but we really need to know, you know, numbers of households and in some of the larger parishes, especially outside the walls, just because the parish was large, a lot of that was still rural. So we're working on that. My suspicion is we're going to be able to show this, but for the moment, I've got no statistical backup for that. Okay, so what else are we doing with this? One thing that's been very exciting is I have a colleague at McMaster, Hendrik Poynar, who works on ancient DNA. One of the things I've got, you know, I can identify in one particular week in 1665, there was an enormous number of people who all died of plague, and I know where they're buried. So we have the potential to actually figure out what the pathogen was, because with the modern techniques, you might be able to sequence at least bacteria from teeth of victims, and more than that, in fact, I learned today that we've now got permission to dig in the largest plague pit in London. So sometime before long, hoping so we can core down, get samples, and Hendrik is doing a good job of convincing me that if Yersinia pestis was behind it, then he'll be able to detect it. So we'll see, because of course that would be direct evidence for what the pathogen was. And if there is no Yersinia pestis, well, that's he'll also be able to sequence all sorts of other things. We might get some clues to what it was. So other open questions, you know, really what's behind that very complicated temporal pattern of these plague epidemics, that's another talk. And very interesting, why was there no plague in London after 1665? Because we saw there were these four giant epidemics killed. Why would it disappear in 1665? I think that's an important question. Okay. Plague is not the only thing, as you could tell from that first data slide that's listed in these bills of mortality. So What else? Well, I have students and postdocs working on a variety of other diseases that we're digitizing from these records. And I'll just show you a little bit of data. So smallpox. You can see from this that smallpox was periodic. This is over 130 years. For all these things, we'll eventually have a time series going from continuously from 1661 to basically the present. But we're still in the process of digitizing. And if you blow up sections, the frequency of epidemics changed here. All sorts of interesting things happened in terms of ways of controlling smallpox. So there's lots of interesting things to try to understand here. Tuberculosis. So I showed you there was consumption. Here's this is now from 1665 until 1830, pattern of consumption deaths, which raises all sorts of questions for us to try to understand. And as a lead-in to the next presentation, pertussis, whooping cough in London, here from 1700 until 1880. And of course, part of the pattern here is that the population size of London is increasing a lot, but there's a lot more that's interesting here. And the frequency of epidemics changes. There's all sorts of things happening that I'm looking forward to investigating and trying to understand this disease better and all these other ones. So, well, what am I hoping you're going to remember from all this? I think the main thing is that really, I hope I'm convincing you that these historical documents provide incredibly valuable data that are fantastic resources for understanding infectious disease. And I think we're going to learn a lot of useful things from this, particularly the London data set and various other historical data sets that we can digitize. I've set up this website where ultimately all of this stuff will be available. So far, there's a smattering of data there, but I encourage you to go there and make use of data and learn lots about infectious disease. And about the Great Plague specifically, well, this was a devastating epidemic, but it was caused by a pathogen that was weakly transmissible. And that appears to be a recurrent theme of the most devastating epidemics that we know of. In addition, the Great Plague has some fascinating small-scale spatial structure that we'll hopefully get to the bottom of in the coming months or so. And so I should thank the various faculties that make all of this possible. And to any of you who are in the market for a postdoc, or if you have students or postdocs who are in the market for a postdoc and you thought this was interesting, please talk to me, email me. We have several positions available, so there's a plug. Thank you very much.